I was watching a documentary on HBO, Burden of Proof, and it was one of those documentaries where you wish you had somebody to watch it with. And so immediately I called Jim Clemente, former FBI profiler and friend. And I said, you got to watch this. We need to discuss it.
And I was like, all right, I'll watch it. And but as soon as I started watching it, I was like hooked, totally hooked.
Yeah, it's amazing. Let's not reveal who we think did it yet.
Okay, we won't do that. But I would like to talk. There's a lot of behavior in this. Lots of behavior.
And I think I pinned a lot of it early.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I was proud of my observations, my profiling. I had early opinions.
It's going to be interesting to see how close they are to mine.
Yeah. We should say this. Don't watch this if you haven't watched the documentary.
Right. Yeah. Hold off on watch the documentary first and then watch this.
And then watch this.
Yeah, because, you know, we're probably going to give you a couple of spoilers.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Stephen Pandoz was the older brother to Jennifer Pandoz,
who
went missing in 1987 in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Virginia, right, near where I used to live, and she was 15 years old.
15 years old. We assume at this point she's deceased, unless some miracle, which, to me...
would have been great.
Would be amazing when people reappear, because people do disappear.
Sure. I mean, sometimes they're taken, but they're kept alive. For many years, we've all heard of the very famous cases that have happened or infamous cases. But in this case, what was really interesting is what was really interesting is the family dynamic and all the different personalities and how they clashed and mixed together and really interesting. And also how long they shot this documentary.
It's right.
Over the course of 7 years.
Right. So let's start there. The first thing is the documentary opens on a recreation, which I hate. Get to the real people. Because they're fascinating. Stephen Pandoz is a fascinating person.
Yes, but
get to the real people. So it starts on a recreation.
Yes.
I object.
Okay, but I just have to weigh in on that. The recreations in this documentary were the best I've ever seen.
Really?
Yes, because, you know, sometimes they try to be very, you know, sort of blurry and nefarious and general, but they always still look like, you know, they're stiff people acting.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, I think they set a particular tone, and I thought they were incredibly real. You know, you just felt like you were in the situation, as opposed to, you know, somebody's acting, some goofballs are acting this.
Yeah.
I really think they spent a tremendous amount of time, effort, and energy to get them right. And even though they started on a recreation, you didn't know it was a recreation really yet. But when you do find out, I wasn't that disappointed.
So the second thought I had,
you had a thought,
was this, that they filmed it over 7 years.
Yeah.
So a lot of these documentaries, I feel like through editing, they manipulate us to feel a certain way. But we were getting the information in real time, as were the subjects in the documentary. So it wasn't like, we're going to film for 6 months and we already have this information. We're going to misdirect. I object in crime documentaries when they misdirect the viewer to build tension.
Sure.
This felt like genuine tension.
It built genuine tension because it, like you said, it was chronological. It basically showed you how things evolve over the course of 7 years. And, you know, of course, went back. And I thought some of the interactions between the family members were just epic.
My family wouldn't allow this filming.
No.
For sure.
And that's another one. That's part of it. It's like you think about the different motives for the different people and why they agreed to do things, it really reveals a lot.
Right, that's what I want to get into. So the documentary opens and Jennifer Pandoz is on a bike. An actor playing Jennifer Pandoz is biking down the street.
Yeah, I think she's on a scooter.
Maybe it's a scooter, but who knows? Because that's what the first opening... They had different people saying she had a scooter. Some people said she didn't have a scooter. Some people said she was a tomboy. Somebody said she was a girly girl. So they immediately set up this, like, what's real, what isn't, what can you believe?
And, you know, and in the real world, it for me, behaviorally, what it shows is that human beings are multifaceted, and it's very difficult to put any person into a pigeonhole. And what you'll find is that different people get a different side of you. Or people say, you know, we wear masks, right? We wear different kinds of masks for different people in different situations. So I think that was just the manifestation of that. She was different. She was perceived differently to different people.
But how could they not know if she had a moped or not?
Well, they may not have been exposed to that part of her life. In other words, she may have talked about it, but they never saw it. They saw her on a bicycle, not on a moped.
Which is what I saw. I saw her on a bicycle at the beginning.
Well,
I watched the beginning twice. And then,
but she was like this on a moped.
But were they trying to set it up that she could have disappeared on this moped? Because that never came back.
It never came back. I think what it was meant, the scene to me, told me that she was kind of a free spirit, that she would do things
right
on her own way. She was, and we found out all other times, you know, she had no filter. She would say what was on her mind, and she would do what she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes may not have been the healthiest thing for her.
Right, right. So here's what makes this documentary fascinating. Is Stephen Pandoz, S-T-E-P-H-A-N.
Yeah, normally Stephen, you would call that Stephen, but...
But it is Stephen.
Yeah, everybody calls him Stephen.
He hardcore believes to his every being, I think was the quote, that his dad murdered his sister and that his mom helped in the cover-up to the point Stephen Pandoz sued his parents, not for money, but... for a court to say, yes, your parents did kill the daughter. So the night before she went missing, she was on the phone with a friend.
Yes.
And the father came in and said, hey, get off the phone. And the kid didn't get off the phone. This is a very classic disagreement parents
have. I mean, I was thinking, and what's crazy is, you know, it's the phone, the house phone, right? It's not a cell phone.
Right.
It's the house phone. And I remember as a kid, always, you know, making sure that we had a long wire so you could take the phone upstairs to your room or sit on the staircase and have some privacy instead of being in the, you know, the family areas.
I had to get wire connectors. So you'd have a 50-foot wire, then it'd go into another wire. And by the way, my mom listened all the time to calls, like the NSA. She was eavesdropping, and she would, like, come and, like, comment on
my
conversations.
Your mom may be NSA.
Yeah.
I mean, come
she
on.
She could be. But she would comment later. So
she would comment?
Yeah. I grew up without privacy. So this,
wow.
You know, Patriot Act thing, which we released a clip this week, of us discussing the Patriot Act and how all of our communication is being recorded by the NSA.
And your mom.
And my mom. And so.
Yeah, so being, you know, back in that time, you know, when kids didn't have their own phone, they didn't have their own autonomy.
Yeah.
And, you know, being on the phone, especially if you had siblings around your age, which I had five siblings, like all of us are about a year apart. So, you know, everybody was competing for that phone. And my parents, you know, obviously wanted to have the phone off. You know, so they wanted to have nobody on the phone so that we could get calls, because that was before call waiting.
That's
and
right.
All that.
Busy signals.
Right. So,
wow.
You know, if they got an important phone call, their kids were on the phone from the time you got home from school till the time you went to sleep. So
my dad grew up, they didn't even have their own phone. It was called a party line, which they shared with other people. So you'd pick up and you'd hear people talking and then you'd hang up.
You weren't your mother. Your mother
my
would
mom's listen.
And the NSA.
My mom's listening right now, just so you know.
Hi,
but
Mom.
What's also really cute and reminded me a lot of my childhood, how they communicated, not just they're using landlines at their parents' house, but also passing notes. She had a notebook where she would write to a friend and then give it to the friend, then the friend would write in the notebook and then pass it back. And it's basically texting before texting.
Right.
And
it's low-tech texting.
Yeah. On my podcast, I read notes that I passed back and forth with a girl when I was in high school that I probably had a crush on.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So the other thing was how they folded the notes. Right? Did you catch that? So some of the notes were folded, you know, in half and then in half again. Some of them were folded in some sort of hexagonal way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that was, you know, a little extra effort because she cared about the person.
Yeah,
that she was writing.
Guys
to.
Fold it up like a football and they flick it right at the person. That's what dudes do.
I'm sure you probably were doing spitballs at people too.
I never was a spitball person, really? But wet willy. I like when you put you wet your finger, you put it in the person's ear. That one I like. So the father says to Jennifer Pandos, get off the phone.
Right.
Now, the father is a bit gruff. It comes out later that he was abusive. Just let me set the story up.
Okay.
That he was abusive. He went to Vietnam. When Stephen was born, he went right away, was deployed.
Shortly
and he was a gunner on a helicopter. And he remembers his first kill. So he came back probably a different person.
Yeah, well, a lot of people came back from Vietnam a different person. And they were treated horribly when they came back, which was really bad. They didn't go there because they wanted to go there. Most of the people who were in the Vietnam War were drafted, and it was a questionable war, and it was limited warfare, and it just dragged on decades. I mean, it was just way, way too long, and it was a nasty war because it wasn't fighting against an army. It was basically fighting against civilian soldiers.
Right.
And so it was really nasty.
I don't know if you picked up on it, but Stephen said that he had killed a woman.
Yes, I did pick up on it. Yeah.
Right. But
and that
also
was his first kill.
Right. Yeah. But weren't the VC, the Viet Cong, using civilians?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Absolutely. They were using women and children.
Yeah.
And yeah, they would attach a bomb to a kid and have him run into the arms of a soldier and blow him up.
Right. So he comes back. Jennifer's born a couple of years later, and Stephen, at the time that she went missing, is off in college. I thought it was curious they never mentioned where he went to college, but they said it was close. So was it a UVA or?
No, he was away. They said he
at
was
college.
Away at college.
At college.
I thought he was way far, but I didn't know it was close.
Did you, I wanted to ask you this at the beginning. Did you take, all these notes are from watching the documentary. Did you read anything? Or is this pure?
No, I
my
just
only
did
knowledge
based
is a documentary.
On, yeah,
great.
Just based on the documentary.
So the father, we're going to take you back to that night that Jennifer went missing. Father comes in, says, get off the phone. She doesn't get off the phone. He yells at her again and says, get off the GD goddamn, right? And the friend hears this, and the friend said, I'd never heard Mr. Pandos.
In that tone.
In that tone. And Stephen, the son, said, because he was interviewing her, the friend said, yeah, I was scared of him.
Yeah,
he
wasn't safe.
He was abusive physically
right.
and emotionally, and that he spent most of his time out of the house at the golf course, and she would go away for weekends at a time.
Yeah, spend time with her friends. Right. Yeah, to get away from the home. But yeah, let's talk about him, Dad. So they're saying he had PTSD, which is common when you're going through combat and you come back and the entire country despises you because you were at a war that you didn't want to be at.
Right.
But anyway, that turned a lot of people off. And there was a whole now counterculture at this time of separation of these Vietnam vets. And so it exacerbated things that happened while they were away. And apparently he didn't get any treatment for it. And he took it out on the people close to him.
And it's still an issue, right? Vets now still aren't getting the treatment that they need.
Absolutely not. I can't remember how many it is. Is it 20 a day that commit suicide?
It's a lot. When you were in the FBI, were there a lot of vets? Is that a progression?
There were, yes. There were a bunch of people from the military. You know, I think that there is, you know, there's probably 10 or 15% of FBI agents were former military.
Yeah.
But this guy, I'm not going to excuse his behavior because he was suffering from PTSD.
Right.
I mean, it's one thing to be, you know, suffering from PTSD. It's another thing to take it out on your family and be physically and emotionally abusive. He seemed to be a coercive controller. In other words, the mother seemed to be controlled by him.
That and was certainly Stephen's point of view.
Yeah.
She never said this.
She never said this. However, her behavior screamed it.
Well, that was Stephen's accusation that I mean, there's so much that you, the note, did the mom write the note? There's so all much right, that's well, going gotta, on. We got to get into all that. So let's just go chronologically to the missing part.
Okay.
So she eventually, I assume, gets off the phone.
Yes.
Goes to bed. The mom wakes up in the morning. Right. So either at this point, the father killed her, or she ran off, or she was abducted. But in the morning, the mother goes downstairs, tries the daughter's door, and it's locked, which is interesting that it would be
locked from the inside.
From the inside. She calls the father downstairs. He doesn't have his glasses. He seems grumpy. Seems like he's about to hit somebody already.
Right.
And they get the door open and they find a note. Now, this to me is
the daughter's gone, right?
The door's locked. They find a note. The mother doesn't know if the note was found on the bed or on the foot of the bed in one of like a locker. The wood locker. Is that? How could you not? What a moment in your life that your daughter is gone. There's no panic from them. They thought she may have run.
That is a totally different thing. So you're talking about if this is a traumatic event, then trauma can affect what we remember from it. So I wasn't put off at all about the fact that she couldn't remember exactly where this note was found. But the fact that she... You know, this note, and what I tried to do was get a copy of it online, the full note, but I couldn't find the entire note, right? But I was able to take pictures of it successively, so that I could see most of it.
Okay.
But this note is very interesting, okay?
Now I'm glad I didn't watch the documentary with you. We'd have to pause it so you can take screenshots.
Yes.
Take pictures of the screen with your camera.
Yeah, but this note reminded me a lot of
John Benet Ramsey. Right. Am I right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Did you work on that case?
I did work on that case for years, yes. And in the note here, in this case, it was a bizarre note. Let me put it this way.
Right.
And let me point out the things that I found just from the top, why it was bizarre. So it was clearly written in very bad handwriting that appeared to be opposite hand. And so what that means is it was an attempt to hide who was writing the letter, right? Now, after that, you look at what was said. So it addresses the parents as Mr. and Mrs. What does that tell you? Did that tell you anything?
That she didn't write it.
No, but it's like you're looking up to the person.
Okay.
You're looking up to the people you're addressing it to.
Mm.
You don't... When you go to somebody's house when you're a kid and you meet their parents, you don't say, hey, Bob and Betty, right? You say, hello, Mr. and Mrs., right?
But also, I just realized this, Jennifer doesn't call her dad. She calls him by his first name.
Right.
So she doesn't refer to them as Mr. and Mrs.
Right.
If she were to write that note, which, I mean, she's a big note taker and maker and giver. You knew she didn't write it.
Right. Okay. So then the next sentence is, your daughter is with me. Doesn't use the name.
Hmm.
One thing. And with me is actually separating the two. In other words, it isn't, your daughter and I are going somewhere. It's your daughter is with me. But it separates the daughter and me.
Why?
Because there is some separation between these people, probably antagonistic. So in other words, if you interview a husband and he says, his wife is missing, and he says, and we say, what was the last thing you did with your wife? Okay. And he says, or when's the last time you saw your wife? Well, I went for a drive in the country with my wife on Saturday. I and wife.
Oh, so when you say
so
you keep going into my camera shot with your
That's
hand.
Okay.
Your wife.
Every time.
Talking about a serious topic. You're saying it should have been written.
My wife and I went for a drive together in the country.
So we would say your daughter is with me.
it says...
It should say your daughter. But no, what does it say?
Your daughter and I are together.
What is that? Yeah, so what does that say to you?
It says that there is some kind of antagonistic animosity between the writer of this letter and the daughter. They're not together. In other words, it's not, my boyfriend's coming over and we're running away together from his perspective.
Yeah.
There seems to be some antagonism here. There isn't a connection in the subjects.
So read the line again.
Your daughter is with me.
Okay.
Your daughter is with me.
Do you think she's dead at this point?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that something happened and then the person broke into the house and left this note, wrote and left
you
this
know.
Note.
Okay.
Note was written in the house. It was on the book, the notepad that she had in her house.
Does the tone of that line exclude the boyfriend? And because here are the other subjects, a boyfriend that she's dating, and then some creepy guy who she would babysit for that would buy beer for the kids. And we find out later it has convictions for kidnapping.
Yeah.
And attempted rape.
Right.
Well, that's suspect number one immediately.
Well, it should be, yes. But you're asking, does the way that line is written say that it couldn't be the boyfriend? No, it doesn't say that. What it says is, if it is the boyfriend, because there's other things indicating a personal relationship after that, if it is the boyfriend, there is a problem between them. They're not together.
Not harmony.
Yes.
Okay, let's get back to the physical writing of the letter. If this were to be written weak hand, how good would handwriting analysis be?
Well, I have never seen a case where it has been absolutely conclusive when somebody has tried to disguise it. However, there are certain loops and whirls and ways you make letters and other graphical differences that people can have that are very idiosyncratic. In other words, they're very unique to one person. And the spacing between words is one thing. How you start a particular letter is another thing. But when you're writing offhand, the opposite hand, a lot of times your normal writing traits just disappear. But it can at least... It can get you close, but I don't think it's ever definitive because somebody, it's a forensic countermeasure.
Are there studies where the same piece is given to several handwriting analysis and experts and there's much variation in the results?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's different levels of sophistication of the experts and experience. You know, if you go to sort of, you know, like the Secret Service or the CIA, they probably have pretty good experts that look at stuff all the time and then get things verified. But there's a lot of commercial experts that, you know, really just hang out a shingle and they're not really that great.
Was JonBenet Ramsey weak hand?
It was opposite hand.
It was opposite hand, we call it?
Block letter, yes.
Wow. Block letter. What similarities did you see?
Between the notes?
Yeah.
Well, the notes were very long. And then in this note, in the note with Pandos, with Jennifer Pandos, there was a whole section called, these are some quotes from Jennifer.
Like a hostage.
Like, what the hell?
Right.
What do you mean? These are some quotes. Like, it is so weird. So
I'd like that in my letter, some quotes.
Yeah, but that's...
Somebody texted me a great quote that I said, I forgot I had said it.
Really?
I woke up after drinking some wine and I had a headache and I said, I don't know what's giving me a headache, the wine or me. Well, I think that if I go missing, that should be one of my quotes in the letter.
Okay, so I'll know it's you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But honestly, why would you use that structure? Like, who would do that? This doesn't seem like a very, I don't know, emotionally sophisticated or stable person.
So are you thinking this is the parents?
At this point, I don't know, because I'm trying not to focus on one suspect, right? Or one type of suspect.
Can I tell you why I didn't think it was the parents?
Why?
At that point, Jennifer went missing. In the letter, it said, don't report this to the police for 3 days. Tell my friends that I'm sick. And
put money in my
account. Put money in my account for a doctor's appointment.
No, no, no. Put my money in my account and cancel my doctor's appointment on
Friday.
Did
it say cancel?
It did.
Oh, I thought it was put money in my account so she could go to the doctor. I go, this is the most responsible runaway ever. She's going to go to the doctor?
Well, clearly she's not going to do that.
Okay, so that's one of the questions I had. Okay. Did they see if she showed up for the doctor's appointment?
No, she asked her mother to cancel it. Cancel it. And she also told them, go to work tomorrow because right. I'm not going to call you at home. I'm going to call you, one of you at work.
Why? Why wouldn't she call them at home?
All right, let me put it this way. What I was thinking is she has a very bad relationship with her father. It's iffy with her mother. She probably doesn't want to talk to her father, so she's going to call home. She doesn't want him to answer the phone, so she'll call her mother at work.
She could hang up or say, put mom on.
Or she'll just say, I'll call you mom at work.
Okay. Before we break down even more, we can agree on this. Steven is so tunnel visioned and only has one resolve. He only believes one theory. His father killed his sister. And it could be because he was abused and he wanted to get back at the father. But he couldn't.
Or he believed his father was capable of doing that. And he found out that his father had a heated argument with his sister the night before.
But he, and even the investigators he hired, would only see what fit into their theory.
Right.
Because exactly. At one point, they said, well, this, if she ran away, that would be uncharacteristic. Jennifer never ran away. And then they were like, the film, and I don't know why they never mic. Could you, Mike, if you're doing a documentary and you're going to ask questions and then including the documentary, which pretty much happens in every documentary now, Mike yourself. Because you hear this, and you go, well, this is the investigator hired by Steven.
Interviewed, but then in the background.
Well, so he said, well, this is uncharacteristic. Jennifer never ran away. And then you hear the documentarian go, well, that's not true. She ran away one other time. Yeah, but still, this was uncharacteristic. I'm saying that they would only see things that fit their theory.
Right.
I studied this in school, and I thought immediately, when the mother was brought in for questioning by the police, and we can all agree also that the parents did not act in a way that most people would.
Right.
They didn't call 911 immediately. They didn't get frantic. They didn't go out and search for her. They did claim they sat on some steps looking out a window to see if
she was... their steps.
Yeah. But they... The police person interviewing the mother had a questionnaire and said, is there anything you're holding back that you're not telling us about this crime?
Right.
And she took a long pause and she said, yeah... A note was left behind.
Or I have the note. Here's the note.
I have the note. And I thought, if the parents were creating this note as an alibi, why wouldn't they have brought that forward immediately?
Well, they actually did. It was in the original file, but it was a copy in the file. In other words, the police, the detective who did the original investigation, took a copy of the note, not the original.
Right.
Big mistake. Because that note had valuable information on it, valuable forensic evidence on it, and that was all lost
DNA,
over time.
Yeah, fingerprints.
Yes.
And we should say that this was a
trace evidence.
What's trace evidence? Like a hair?
Hair, fibers, yeah.
And this note was written in 1987. This is handwritten before the proliferation of computers.
DNA. And DNA, right?
No, there was DNA.
Well, there was...
There was DNA. There wasn't DNA testing.
Right.
See, I think like a profiler.
There you go.
Yeah, no, I'm very specific with words and definitions. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah.
No, but what I'm saying is the letter now could be printed out at a Kinko's or would be typed out, but this was a handwritten.
It was handwritten, and it seemed to be written in red ink, and it was written in a page of the notebook that she kept for a very long time, that Jennifer kept for a very long time. And so it was torn out of that. So you could have matched it to the notebook from the pages. You could have also gotten any kind of trace evidence that would have been on it. And it's much better for a handwriting expert to look at the original under a microscope rather than looking at photocopies of it.
Why didn't the investigator take this note, put it in a Ziploc bag, which is all you see when you watch crime shows?
I know.
And then they number it.
Yeah, well, it should be in an Evans bag. It should be sealed, and it should be then sent to the lab.
But they screwed up the whole case.
Because the foundation of the case was a haphazard bullshit. She just ran away. She'll be back in a few days. That's what it is.
That's what it was? Yes, but then they lost the case file.
You say a kid is missing, and it immediately takes the wind out of the sails of any kind of investigative effort. You have to say that the person is missing, endangered.
Mm-hmm.
Endangered is what's important. A 15-year-old girl who can't survive on her own, who doesn't have any source of income, she's going to be at risk. And that's what the parents have to say, and that's how law enforcement has to deal with it.
And the parents didn't call any of their friends for three... Like, why didn't...
Well, this is what I'm saying. The behavior of those parents, they were definitely hiding something. And I think that what the father was hiding was that he was an extremely abusive parent, and he may have felt bad that he did something the night before that caused this to happen. And he may have felt bad that he actually was abusing his kids and his wife.
Interesting.
But
so he may not have murdered Jennifer, but he may have...
But he was showing signs of deceit and deception and hiding something, right? So, and she was also incredibly deceptive. I mean, and let me just say that when she was describing the circumstances, she was talking about, and I didn't hear the shower. And she didn't answer the door.
What do you mean, didn't hear the shower?
The mother said, I didn't hear my daughter in the shower.
Oh, in the morning.
Right.
Right. So in the morning, she would hear her daughter in the shower. When she didn't hear the daughter in the shower,
she said, oh, I think she slept in. Yeah. But she said, I didn't hear the shower. She didn't answer the door. And then the mother said, and finding that note, but finding it there, she went from past tense to present tense. Past tense is how you relate things that happened in the past.
Right.
Present tense is how you relate things that you make up in your mind.
So what did she make up?
Well, finding the note? I don't believe they found the note in the way they say they found the note.
Okay, where do you think they found it?
I don't know. It could have been in her notebook and they tore it out. It could have been... she left it under their door. I don't know. But it did not appear. The fact that she changed tense, she's hiding something about that note. And the fact that they followed two things in the note, in other words, don't call the cops and tell my friends that I'm sick.
But didn't put money in the bank account.
Yeah, because clearly if they thought she was abducted, and that's what they said they thought, then...
Okay.
Why wouldn't you do everything to appease the abductor?
Wait a minute. Did they think she was abducted?
Well, the note said that. She's with us.
No, but with she's us. With and by the way, said daddy figure. Mm-hmm. So either it was the creepy guy that they babysat for, Hendrix, or it's the boyfriend trying to throw a red herring.
Exactly. And that, look, this place, so he's saying he wrote the note there in her bedroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, I'm basically a father figure to her.
Right.
Well, yeah. Why would you, if you were the bad guy, why would you say that in a note?
Okay.
And then why would you follow it up with, these are some of Jennifer's quotes.
Okay. If the parents thought she was kidnapped, which I didn't get that feeling. First of all, they didn't think she was kidnapped. Because if they thought she was kidnapped, they would have called the police immediately.
I don't know. They thought that it would be harmful to their daughter. That's what they said. Why would they put up missing posters and not think she's kidnapped?
That was inconclusive, too, although it came back later that they did put up... Okay, so you're saying that they should put money in there that's a form of ransom.
Yeah.
What if they did not suspect... She was kidnapped, that she ran away because she had run away before and she was like this free spirit.
Mm-hmm.
maybe they thought, we're not going to put money in her account. That will make her come home faster because she'll run out of money.
It's possible, but they never said that. And it would be nice to know from them. They never talked about it. They avoided the questions. And that's another thing that's fairly deceptive appearing, is that the mother kept, well, giving, as Stephen said, what was it? Let me see. Oh, he said they were not emotional and they did not give good answers.
Why? So the parents, if they're not guilty, convicted themselves by having erratic, bizarre, untraditional
behavior and uncaring behavior. Oh, there's another thing. At some point, and this is moving ahead a little bit because I want to say that
look at all these notes. God, I'm going to take a picture of this. It's amazing. Go ahead.
I just have to find it.
You're listening to Jim Clemente, former FBI profiler, and me, Orny Adams. This is the problem with having a lot of notes, Jim. This is the problem.
It is the problem with having a lot of notes, because it was 4 hours, so I wanted to make sure that I had all these details.
You never answered this question. What were the similarities between this and the JonBenet Ramsey note and case? And what came first?
JonBenet Ramsey was 76.
It was in 76?
Yes.
How do I remember that?
No, I'm sorry. Did I say 86?
96.
Yeah, sorry.
Still, how did I remember that? But this is a copycat.
Yeah. Well, similar, because one, it's a long note. It has bizarre things in it. It's written block lettering, reverse hand. It's written on a piece of paper from the house.
Yeah.
It's written on a pen with a pen from the house. And the mother is the only one who couldn't be ruled out originally as the writer.
Interesting.
All those things are the same in the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Wow, they always think the guy does the killing and then the mother writes a note.
There you go. But the point is that at some point, the mom said, I missed that girl. That girl. This is her daughter,
right,
ripped out of her life at 15. And she said, my world ended when I read that note.
Yeah.
But she calls her that girl.
And she never plays.
She never says,
my daughter.
My daughter. Poor Jennifer.
I know, it's strange.
There's a distance there. Tells me she did not love her daughter. She did not have a connection with her daughter.
Well, that's fine.
No, it's not fine. She's her mother.
But she's allowed to not have a connection. But she never said this, which I would say, hey, my daughter is missing, presumed dead, and you're accusing me. Like, I can't even grieve. I didn't do this. I had nothing to do with it. This is what I was saying. I was home. If my husband killed her, I would have heard it. I can hear the shower. He didn't kill her, at least from what I can tell. But she never came out and said stuff. She was never emphatic, Jim. She never sold her innocence.
No,
why
she
is that?
Because she has issues. There are some issues here. Now, are some of the issues because she was being coercively controlled? Are some of the issues because she felt she had no choice? She had to do what her husband wanted her to do? Her husband is a very controlling person, as we find out. You know, we get to interact with him. We get to hear him. We get to see that attempt to control every situation
right.
he's in.
But this kidnapping, murder, runaway happened in 1987, it's now 2017, 2018. They've been divorced for years. He's been to prison for another crime, nonviolent crime, some sort of tax evasion or stealing from clients, funneling money.
Yeah.
She doesn't communicate with him. Stephen has no relationship with him. Why would she still be under his control?
Well, she did communicate with him. When the cop called her in 2006... She seven times emailed her husband. No, the cop called seven times. She emailed her husband every time saying, I need to talk to you first.
And didn't get back to the cop.
Right.
Why was that?
Well, that's, again, it's very evasive. What is going on here? Now, you could say she's a bad person, or you could say she still feels controlled by this guy. I don't know. But it didn't look good for her.
No. No. But
another thing was, she's about to be interviewed, or she's being interviewed by the cop, and then Stephen comes in, and the first thing out of her mouth is, I guess I need a lawyer now.
Yeah, that was strange. And they offered her full immunity.
I know.
Excluding murder. So she could say, and here's my, I have a legal question. When they say full immunity, excluding murder, is that for any crime? You know, I committed a crime the other day. If they gave me full immunity on something else, could I, am I like, hey, am I off the hook for that? Like,
no, it would be transactional immunity generally, unless it specifically says more.
But is it only pertaining to this?
Well, that's
case?
What I'm saying. That's what transactional immunity.
Well, I don't know that.
Okay, sorry. Transactional immunity means it's just this event, whatever we're charging you with in this case.
Right. So she's in her. I have so many questions.
But she said...
She's being interrogated. They offer her full immunity. She can say anything. She can say, my husband killed her. I came in when it was done, cleaned everything up, and wrote the note, and she'd be off the hook.
She could say that, right. But she's also said, he said, just tell, you know, Stephen's telling her, imploring her, just tell the truth, tell what happened. And she said, I'd go to jail for the rest of my life.
Yeah, why'd she say that?
I know. It's an inculpatory statement. And then she said, if I'd had my wits about me 22 years ago, it wouldn't be like this.
Yeah, it's all strange. It's bizarre. And I've never seen an interrogation where they let a family member in.
Well, no, that happens. I mean, it happened in the Watts case, sure. They let the father in and he confessed.
And then he stormed off in the middle. He had had enough.
Yeah.
Was that planned out? That felt planned.
I don't know. He's very emotional, and he shuts down a few times on camera.
And they say that at the beginning. They said, we don't have the evidence to convict somebody. More than likely, this will be resolved by a deathbed confession.
That's what they were saying, but I don't know about that.
Who do you... Okay. The other thing that's fascinating about this documentary is they get everybody on film, every suspect,
I know,
everyone, including the Hendrix guy who's now, I think, homeless. It looked like he was on the side of the road begging for money, has convictions, not a good person, but super believable. And then they get the boyfriend.
That's Charlie May. Charlie May was the homeless guy. The Hendrix guy was the guy that, you know, he was actually...
No, Charlie May is, the one-arm guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And then that's the other thing. The
one-arm band, I mean...
Yeah, it's everything.
I was like, what?
It's everything. And then this guy Hendrix...
Who was the guy that they babysat for, who supposedly gave them alcohol.
Right, and who had been convicted of kidnapping.
And attempted rape.
Yeah, but not buying alcohol for kids. But this is what I love. The police can't find this guy, but the documentary crew can.
Right.
That's what I love, because this is what it comes down to, Jim. If you need a shot, you find the person. That's these documents, they need to tell the story. Right. They're going to find Hendrix.
Yeah, but police... I thought it was, well, except that the police have probably no finances to go and travel and do all that kind
what
of
are
stuff.
What are the ethical implications of a documentary crew inserting themselves in a case like this?
Well, it can be difficult. I've done investigative documentaries, and I'm careful. I am a lawyer. I'm a former FBI agent. I'm forensically sophisticated. I know how not to screw up a case, but I don't know that the producers in this case, for example, when she got the box of letters from the mother, one of the producers, the interviewer, the camera person, whatever, she opens it up and touches it and then closes it and then throws it down on the table and lets Stephen go through it. None of them are wearing gloves.
Right.
They're contaminating evidence. None of them are, you know, they don't have a face mask on, so they're breathing their own DNA on top of it. They ruined so many things.
Yeah, and this made me nervous. He was like, I'm going to overnight ship it to you. Right. And I'm like, no, drive it down or scan it and send it.
Can I just tell you a secret, though?
Yeah.
The FBI overnight ships evidence all the time.
FedEx or UPS?
I can't tell you.
DHL? We have to do an episode on DHL. Do you know the story of the H guy?
No, but I know my buddy is a pilot for DHL.
No, no, no. This isn't about your buddy. Listen to me.
Well, it could be about my buddy.
Hinderbrand, I think his name is.
Okay. Was he a Nazi?
No. Maybe that's not. But the H in DHL, I think, was a pedophile.
Oh, geez. Really?
Yeah. Somebody told me they're making a movie. I said, I need the director on my podcast to discuss this.
Wow.
He's one of those people that went to one of those islands and then had sex with underage women, impregnated a lot of them, and dozens came forward after he died.
Oh, jeez.
I had another thought. You're really good at derailing my thoughts, Jim Clemente.
Well, I try hard to.
I had another thought about... Oh, here's the other thing. Do you remember the scene in the documentary? What's this called? Reasonable Doubt? What is this called?
Burden of proof.
It's a dumb... Excuse me. Now I'm looking into the camera. Now I'm talking to whoever named this documentary. I don't know if it's HBO or the producers, but Burden of Proof is a dumb name for this documentary.
No, it isn't. It's like Reasonable Doubt. It's a term of law that everybody knows.
I get it, but it sounds like a John Grisham film.
Right, but Reasonable Doubt was actually written by Philip Friedman, who's a friend of mine.
But does he drive a truck for DHL too?
No, but Burden of Proof was meant to say that, you know, look, Stephen was looking for proof of whether his parents did it or not. And that's what the burden that it put on his life and how it changed his family relationships and all that stuff. That's what it's about. I thought it was a very good title.
You know what I love? I love, because I know producers, I know directors and documentary, I know how they work. And they manipulate you.
They can, yes.
You think they're your friend. And Stephen thought that they were his friend the whole time. He would call them. He was very buddy-buddy with them. But there was a shocking moment when the police found the lost case file, and it took 6 months for the documentary people to tell him. And he's like, and you saw him just dissolve. All his spirit just left his body, and he thought, well, I wish somebody had told me that.
Well, I mean, just a minor correction there. What he responded to.
I'm not open
to
being corrected.
I know you're not, but I'm just going to tell you what the truth was. So the time he made that statement was when the documentarian told him that they had held a secret grand jury 6 months earlier.
Okay.
It could have been 8 months earlier, but he didn't know that they pulled... two of these people in front of the grand jury. And so that's what he made that statement about. And yeah, they were hiding things, but I think they were doing it, trying to keep it, you know, verite. They were trying to keep to the truth. So they weren't giving him information that he didn't know. They were taking information from him. And I think one of the things when they found the file, and that was another thing, when they found the file, when the police found the file later, they said it was in a box of old files in the bottom of the storage, you know, evidence storage room. Well, that is so typically normal, you know, because... Yeah, because...
But they had searched it four times.
Three times. Yeah, but... So there are two possibilities. One is it wasn't there for a long period of time and somebody put it back. Mm. Now, that could have been the investigator took it home with him and he retired and it was on his shelf somewhere. And then he said... Oh, geez, I forgot. And he sent it back. Or it was there all the time. And all people do, they look, they see the label on the box. They say, oh, that's not it. And they go on to the next one. They didn't actually go through the documents in each box.
I think they said they went through the boxes.
Well, she didn't. She said it was searched three times. Hmm. And then it was there.
Yeah. How did the documentary crew find out about a secret,
a secret grand jury?
Yeah, how did they find out about a secret grand jury?
I think they were staking out the place. They were staking out the place or the people.
But they were there that day.
I know. So they were, they
you
probably...
You think they hired somebody to follow?
Yes, I do, yes. We did that.
So here's what I thought. My early impressions were the parents didn't do it. Because they're on camera way too much. They're agreeing to too many interviews. And I just don't think that they would. That was my feeling.
Well, I think the father and the mother went on camera for two very different reasons. I think the mother went on camera because she was cooperating. And Steven said, you know, a couple times, she has done everything I've asked her to. So in other words, I hate her, keep her at a distance, da 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 da. But every time I ask her to do something, she does it. That's a little inconsistent behavior. Yeah. Why are you feeling that way? The father wanted 15 minutes of fame. You could tell he was
really?
Just, oh my God, he was so friggin' eating that up. Are you kidding me?
Wait a minute.
What
this
does
guy-
he do when he sits down? The first thing he says is, I'm just going to tell you. In other words, don't ask me a question yet.
I hated that. He goes, listen, don't ask. If you don't want the truth, if you don't want somebody who says what's on their mind, then we're going to stop right now. Now, what's your first question? Like, it was really, what was that?
It was him trying to control.
I thought he was also trying to set it up. That
it's also ego.
He doesn't lie.
Yes, he's a good person.
You're only going to get the truth from me.
Right.
The mother, I had another question about the father and the, oh, what type of guy lets his wife, who hasn't been with him the whole time since 1987, the second wife, third wife, I'm sorry, she answered all the questions. It felt to me, Svengali, it's felt very like captive prisoner type behavior, where she was convinced and was his advocate.
Yes.
And was doing most of the talking with Stephen. When Stephen called, Stephen called his father. First, he sent over a bunch of papers and said, look at these papers, and then I'm going to call you to talk about it. Now, I never thought the father would pick up. You have your father on the phone. Why would you ever not, you know,
right.
and he still calls him dad. He calls his father dad, but Jennifer calls the father by
Ronald.
His first name. Like, he hates his father. He's convinced 100% that his father murdered his younger sister, Jennifer, and yet he still calls him dad. This show, it's the psychology in this entire thing, the fact that, let's say, his mother had nothing to do with this and didn't murder, the father didn't murder, let's say the parents had nothing to do with this. He has cut his mother out of his life and his daughter's lives. She has not had any sort of interaction with her granddaughters.
I know. And
is he going to feel as a human being if it turns out they didn't do it?
Well, I think we get serious insights into that during the show. I don't want to ruin too many things. I don't want to.
No, we already put out a disclaimer. This is not a spoiler alert. You should only be watching this or listening to this if you've watched, not Reasonable Doubt, Guilty by Association. What's it called? Burden of proof. Yeah. You should only be watching this, listening to this if you've watched Burden of Proof on HBO or Max.
Yeah.
Now HBO is Max. What? Wasn't HBO the bigger name, bigger brand over Max?
Yeah, it was HBO, then it was HBO Max, and now it's Max. But I still have both icons on my TV. I don't understand it.
I don't know what I'm watching. But, I don't know what I'm paying for either.
But let me just say that then, you know, there was also a profiler from the Virginia State Police on there. And, you know, he did some things that, you know, he explained what he did in a very good and accurate way. But at the same time, sort of had to retrace his steps a little bit and say, well, I guess I shouldn't have said this, you know, and he had to back off on one of the lines.
The handwriting?
No, he was the profiler.
He had a line that sort of said, sort of pointed it towards the parents.
Right, he did. And then he said, I should have left it at somebody who has a close intimate relationship with the victim.
In other words, not necessarily the parents.
Right.
Why wasn't an FBI profiler on this case? Why?
Well, you know, we trained.
Police?
Yeah, it was the state police.
State police.
We trained profilers, and, you know, every agency has a right to get their own, to staff their own department. And so, you know, this is a guy that apparently did this for a living for the Virginia State Police. You know, I may have trained that guy myself. I don't know, because I did a lot of training when I was in the FBI of local and state.
What is the training process? And is this something that's innate? The ability to profile somebody feels like it's something that can't be taught. How do they
teach
you?
You just contradicted yourself. But
how did I contradict myself?
You said it can't be taught, but how did they teach you?
No, well, because I don't think it can be taught. I don't think stand-up comedy can be taught. I don't think, I think you,
well, you can teach it, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be good at it, right? In both areas. Somebody can teach comedy, but that doesn't mean they're going to, the person they're teaching is going to be good at it.
That I contradicted myself because I said, I believe it's innate. Okay. I believe it's something you're born with. Well, I think it's a priori reasoning.
Anyway, the point is that they do try to pick people who have open minds. They're creative. They're not rigid in their thinking. Mm-hmm. They have imagination. So they try to get people like that, because if you don't have those things, you're not going to be a good profiler.
Is the FBI rigid in their thinking?
Oh, yeah, most of the time, yes. But we in the BAU have a different mandate, and so we're not as rigid as the rest of the FBI is.
And how does rigidity serve the FBI?
Well, first of all, being rigid is the opposite of having mental health. Let me put it that way. All right? The fact that you have flexibility, that's the hallmark of mental health, because life throws all sorts of curveballs at you.
Right.
If you can only see in one direction, if you can only react to things in one way, you're not going to survive life very well. To be able to be agile and flexible is to be able to maintain mental health. So the same thing goes with when you're actually working cases that are, you know, very dark, they can be very depressing. Right. You have to have the ability to sort of bob and weave. You have to have the ability to think not like you normally would, but like the offender would, because you have to try to understand that person. And you look at their behavior, you see how they did it, try to determine why they did it, and that leads you to who did it or what kind of person did it. Mm. So it's a mixture of art and science. You know, there's psychology in it, and there's behavior in it, and there's
imagination. But is there like a classroom? You sit in a classroium with other candidates?
We had a 480-hour course once we got into the unit. It's basically not one-on-one, but very low numbers, you know, 1-on-2 or 1-on-6, one teacher for 6 students at a time. And
would they take like that line you found in the note and say, how do you interpret this line?
Yeah, sure. They would go through it. They would do all sorts of things. We would go through hundreds of cases, and there's dozens of courses that we take. But like psychopathy, we were taught by Dr. Robert Hare, who created the psychopathy checklist.
And what is that for the listeners? Of course, I know what that is.
Well, it's a list of 20 factors that you rate somebody through indirect personality assessment. And if they score over 30 on this list, then they are classified as a psychopath. Hmm. And so we had the experts in the field, who are many of them are on our board of advisors, they would come in and teach the courses directly. In other words, we're not learning from somebody who learned from somebody who learned from somebody. Yeah. We learn from the people who actually are the top in their field.
And did you feel prepared when you were done with these courses?
Well, then you do that. And then for 2 years, you go around to the different units in the BAU and work under a experienced profiler and work cases with them. And then after you get certified, you then go off and do cases on your own.
Do you remember the first person you ever interrogated alone?
Yeah.
How did it feel? Were you thinking, I'm not prepared for this, I shouldn't be here?
No, because the first person I ever interrogated alone was by accident, basically.
Oh.
Because I was just asked to babysit this guy while the agent who was working the case was doing the paperwork. And when I got in there, I saw this guy was very nervous and, you know, clearly like stressed to the max. Me being a human being, I just thought I would try to calm him down a little bit, engage him in conversation, build some rapport. And then I asked him questions. I asked him, you know, natural questions. What are you here for? What was he asking you about? Why did he seem so upset when he left? And then this guy just build his guts. He told me everything. I had him write it out on a piece of paper. And when my friend came back, I had a full confession.
And what was he confessing to?
He was confessing to bank robberies.
Oh. That's right. You were in the bank robbery division.
I was.
And then you went into child abductions and and crimes against kids.
Children and, you know, serial killers and serial rapists. Yeah. It's a lot of stuff, but...
So let me ask you this, Jim Clemente, former FBI profiler and podcast host with millions of downloads. I know, you always get nervous when the helicopters go over.
No, I don't get nervous. Understand?
I live in Los Angeles. We're in Big Yellow. This is my studio. This is where I do my own podcast, What's Wrong with Oney Adams. This is not that. This is just us having a conversation.
Shooting the breeze about a show.
About some documentary that I can't remember the name of. I think it's Burden of Proof.
There you go. You got it right. Yay.
So let me ask you this, Jim. This is my question. As a profiler, having the profiler brain, what were your thoughts the first time they interviewed the boyfriend of Jennifer?
It's interesting because they interviewed him, and this is something you should never do when you're doing a law enforcement interview. They interviewed him with his current wife. You're going to get, remember how I said you're different people, the different people?
Right, like the father and his current wife answering for him.
Exactly.
It's a buffer.
You never do that.
But this wasn't a police interview. This is the documentary.
I know, but it's an investigative interview, and it should have been done properly.
What if he was like, the only way I'm going on camera is if my wife is with me?
Well, then that would have been an indicator to me that there's a problem.
Okay.
So he, you know... The most revealing thing he ever said was, in answer to a question about whether or not he had anything to do with the disappearance of Jennifer, he said, what? I was 16 at the time.
Huh.
He didn't answer the question. He avoided it. And he was saying, well, what I did was a 16-year-old doing something. You know, I'm old now. That actually made the hair stand up on the back of my neck a
little bit. Did you think he was a suspect at that point?
Well, at that point, I said, what the fuck did he do? You know, and then I thought, there's also a thing you have to always do. When somebody indicates some kind of deception, like avoiding answering the question, you always have to think, why is he avoiding answering the question? His wife is sitting there.
Mm.
Maybe it's because when he was going out with his wife... He was going out with Jennifer, too. And that may have been why he had this elevated anxiety.
This is the second time this week you've said something like this. When I interviewed Mike Love of the Beach Boys, you listened to the interview. This was I have a radio show on KFI AM and iHeartRadio, and I interviewed Mike Love of the Beach Boys. He's got three shows here at the Hollywood Bowl. And I asked him, I said, you could never really enjoy your songs, the Beach Boys songs, like we could.
We could.
Yeah, to you, it would represent work, or maybe you're fighting with the band members that day. Maybe you had a breakup with and he said, no, I could enjoy them. And he was like pushing back. I didn't like his answer.
Mm.
I went further. I said, okay, well, a lot of guys get laid to your songs. Have you ever made love? I cleaned it up because he's 82. Have you ever made love to one of your songs? And he said, oh, you know, gentleman never tells. And you said what?
He was trying to avoid having his wife hear the answer to that question.
And once again, that's what you think is going on. In this documentary, when I saw the boyfriend, and at this point in the documentary, they've hinted that he probably isn't involved. But I saw him look off to the side at one point, which I go, that's weird. Maybe he's just uncomfortable on camera. But he wasn't acting like a totally innocent person.
But wasn't he? He was way back, laying way back into the couch, being as far away from the interview as he possibly could. All these physical things.
But wouldn't that say leaning he's comfortable? Into it,
well, no, that's what I'm saying. He wasn't comfortable, but he also was... He was not saying the kinds of things that you would expect somebody to say who was being totally open and honest.
Yeah.
But anytime I see somebody who is acting somewhat deceptive, you don't automatically think, they're guilty. You think, why are they being deceptive? What is it? And is it something about this case, or is it something totally different? Like he's sitting next to his wife. He's on camera for the first time in his life.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these things that could add to it. What you have to do in the real world, and they have this deception expert that came in, what you have to do is norm the person. You have to actually spend a good deal of time talking to that person, mm-hmm. not under the stressful environment, not on camera, not, you know, asking questions about that, but looking at the indications of how they convey information normally. And then when you're interrogating them, you look for changes in that behavior.
Okay, so let's get into that, because this is the first indication that there might be a crack in Stephen's theory. And then that his father murdered his sister and the mother helped cover it up, because they hired a profiler, right, mm-hmm. to come in, this woman, and they sat down with
the mother.
Well, no,
she wasn't a profiler. She was an investigator, and she was a deception expert.
Okay. She determined that the mother was being honest.
Well, she said she was being honest, that she felt that she was being truthful. And there were some things that the mother did that I thought, you know, were pretty, you know, pretty truthful. But there were some things that were incredibly deceptive.
What was truthful?
Well, when she was talking about how her son, you know, cut her off and how that affected her, there was a very, very intense change in her demeanor. And, you know, you have to understand that the majority of time we saw the mother on screen, she was not emotional, period.
Yeah.
She did not convey any kind of, and this is something that all of her relatives and friends said when she conveyed the information about Jennifer being missing, she was not hysterical. She was not upset. And that's unusual.
Right.
But that's the norm for her.
Huh. That's so now you know that.
Yeah, well, now we see that.
Yeah.
We know that. And so now where do we see changes in that behavior? Well, she obviously is very hurt by what her son Stephen did. Yeah. Accusing her and keeping her away from her grandchildren. Those things hurt her. But she also did something incredibly deceptive. When the detective called her about her missing daughter's case, she didn't answer the phone. She didn't call the detective
back. And didn't ask, did you find my daughter?
Never. Well, at some point she was doing that, but not years later. But she called her husband, or she emailed her husband several times and said, I need to talk to you before I call her back. That seems to be very guilty behavior. There's something about it. She is either still under his control or they are hiding something together.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward.
What if what they're hiding is that the husband did smack Jennifer around that night, beat her up, put her in a position where she had to run away? What if that's what they're hiding? It could be it.
Wow. I didn't even think of that.
Well, they're hiding something together.
Still, to this day?
Yes.
Why? So they're not completely innocent?
No, they're not. Well, first of all, the husband's not innocent because he beat his kids and certainly abused his wife. I mean, that's not innocent behavior. He's not a sweet, loving guy.
So nobody's clean in this, because what happens is they found the file, and in the file, they found that the parents actually were active. They were calling the police. They were putting up posters.
Right.
They were asking questions. They went to people's houses and stuff like that. And they found that there was a person that they interviewed with one arm who they brought in and claims that the boyfriend called him and said, how do you get rid of a body?
Right.
During this time period.
Right. And that, unfortunately, was not followed up on.
And by the way, fortunately for me, nobody's ever asked me how to get rid of a body, but I would ask more questions. I'd have some follow-ups, like, well, why are you asking me this? Did you kill somebody? I would probably start recording. I would get it on tape. I would also think this could be my chance to have a breakout documentary of my own.
Yes.
Well, I would also think of ways to, you know.
You know, I told you that in certain states, you're not allowed to record conversations, the audio conversations between two people.
Let me guess.
Unless they both consent, like in California, that's a two-party consent state.
Yeah.
But there are other states where it's a one-party consent.
Yeah.
But even in a two-party consent state, you can record if there's a reasonable expectation that the person is going to confess to a crime.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How about this?
What?
I say, hey, they go, hey, I want to get rid of a body. I go, you know what? I got the solution. Give me an hour. Then I drive. I drive to the Nevada border where it's a one-way record law. And I hit record and I get them on tape. You know, it blows my mind when people are confessed to and they don't come forward with that information. And he comes forward and he said, yeah, he asked me. I said, there are these construction sites. They have to use this boric acid. What's it called?
I don't know. Let's not talk about what it is.
They use it to clean the bricks. And more than likely, now we believe the boyfriend committed this murder.
It's possible. And, what we know is this guy, this one-armed man, he gave one very detailed statement to the police, and he gave another less detailed statement and more evasive statement to Steven and the documentarians.
Yeah.
So those inconsistencies raise questions. Was he more involved? Did he know more about it? Did he actually conspire with the boyfriend to get rid of his body rather than ask...
Let's give him immunity.
Rather than answer innocuous questions and not be involved at all.
The police believe there might be an arrest or that they have strong evidence to arrest somebody eventually. There's no conclusion in this documentary, which, when there's four episodes and there's about 5-10 minutes left in the episode and Steven starts saying, I know, wouldn't it be nice if we could wrap this all up? I go, oh no, there's not going to be an arrest. Like at minimum, I thought there was going to be an arrest and then there would be more to the documentary, like when the trial airs. Because you know what? Dateline, in 48 hours, they do that. They hook us in with like a 1 hour, introduce the case, and then we go, well, there's no verdict? Then we got to come back about 6 months later or a year later for 2 hour. They get us twice on the same sort of story. I don't like it. I don't like it. So this burden of proof. So where do you stand now? What do you believe?
Well, it's clear that the boyfriend's handwriting couldn't be ruled out as the writer of the note. The boyfriend apparently was asking about getting rid of the body. The boyfriend apparently...
Which a lot of 16-year-old boys do, right?
And apparently he confessed to this guy, May. And I don't know how reliable that is. You said he's very reliable. I don't know. But he...
Who, May?
May, yeah.
He did pray at the end of the meeting.
Oh, well, that doesn't do a goddamn thing for me.
Really?
Sorry, yeah.
Have you ever interviewed somebody and they asked you to hold their hand and pray?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
There's all sorts of people. Come on. Yeah. And they have all sorts
of... Doesn't mean you've come in contact with them in an interrogation.
I've come in contact with lots of them.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. But the point is that it does appear that there's a high probability that he was involved. And the question is whether or not he threatened her to take her or he... lured her away and then came back and put that note in there.
Okay.
That would be a highly, highly suspicious
thing. Well, how did the note get there then?
Well, look, either he came in with her and said, I'm going to take you away and everything's going to be fine, but he had other plans, or he was going to take her away and, but didn't want her to ruin his relationship with his girlfriend at the time.
But how would she have communicated with him? Because she didn't have a cell phone. She would have had to call from the landline. So here's where we're at. Here's where we're at. We believe that Jennifer was on the phone, was told to get off the GD phone by her father, who was being sort of verbally violent and had been physically violent before. Maybe once she got off the phone, he got physical with her. Steven said that he used to kick him, choke him, punch him. And he never denied that, by the way.
No.
He didn't. The father, when Stephen confronted him, he did not deny that he was...
And he also, one time Stephen confronted him, he said, yeah, hypothetically, I hit her over the head and she died and...
yeah, what was that all about? He did that from prison.
Well, I know.
What are these, if I did it, like these O.J. Simpson did that, if I did it. Well. What? So who did this, Jim? Who did it? So if she, let's say the father beat her. She locks the door. She runs away. She goes to the boyfriend. The boyfriend was abusive to her, too.
Yes.
That came out. So now, the boyfriend... Oh, God. We didn't get into this. They had an abortion together. Jennifer and the boyfriend had an abortion together. Now it's come out that the family, perhaps, threatened him as for statutory rape because she was younger than he was.
Right.
And that's why that could have been a motive for him to kill her. So now the boyfriend kills her, calls the one-armed May... May says, put her in acid. He puts her in acid and she disappears. Well, how does a note get in there? And why don't the parents, why aren't they going, you know what? Yes, I was a bad person. The father, yes, I did get physical and I got physical that night, but I didn't kill, you know,
right.
My daughter. And okay, so now the boyfriend kills her. How does he goes back later and puts the notes? It's a gated community.
I know. Well, it's a gated community. It's surrounded by woods and you can walk through.
Right.
There's no problem. It's a mile walk.
So help me understand who did this.
Well, look, we don't know exactly who did it. And we can't say that the boyfriend did it, but we can say that he is a prime suspect at this point. But the thing is, how did it go down? What is the point of that note? To me, having him say these are quotes from Jennifer in the note is a very bizarre thing. And I can't imagine a scenario in which she's sitting there and he says these are quotes from her. It seems like past tense.
So do you believe she was dead when that note was written?
It's possible. But
what do you believe?
It's possible.
What does that mean? It's possible.
It's highly unlikely.
So you think she was alive when it was written?
Yes, but I can't see a situation in which she's in the room with him, and instead of saying, Jennifer says, or Jennifer said this,
yeah.
He said, these are quotes from Jennifer. What is going on there?
Do you think the documentary gave us a fair representation of the facts?
No, I think they front-loaded a lot of suspicion. Like you know, because of the fact that they did it chronologically, they certainly front-loaded all the facts that made the parents look guilty at the beginning.
And if the parents aren't guilty, Stephen, first of all, he'll have no relationship with the father. He doesn't want to because he was abusive.
Right.
But he will feel horrible about his mother for the rest of his life.
Unless he repairs it. I mean, that's a good thing about relationships. You can repair them.
What do you think happens here? And at what point...
I think he's already started, you know, building bridges to the mother. And I'm sure that, you know, I mean, there was that very emotional scene where they're hugging each other. He said he loved her and she didn't want to let him go.
Yeah.
And that was touching. That was, you know, she said, don't say goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, because I guess she knew the last time he said goodbye.
So maybe we just have to accept that we'll never have the answers. To this.
Yeah, that's unfortunately part of law enforcement. Unfortunately, there are crimes that we still have not resolved, you know, decades later. And that really bothers me. You know, there were child abductions where, you know, I had hoped that we'd be able to tell the parents what actually happened to their child. And
did you get in trouble for speculating too much with the JonBenet Ramsey case?
No, I didn't get in any trouble.
Oh, I thought they sued you.
That doesn't mean, it doesn't mean I speculated too much, and B, it doesn't mean I got in trouble.
But didn't they sue you?
Yeah, but anybody could sue anybody for any reason.
Okay.
There's no controls on who can sue anybody for what.
So how would you sum this up? Jim Clemente, as former FBI profiler, what can you leave the listeners with? Any comfort at all? Any theory? What would you speculate happened?
Well,
There's kids screaming. It's great.
Is that kids screaming?
It's great. July 4th. It's beautiful.
Okay.
I love. I got to tell you, the sound of
somebody was being murdered.
The
I'm
sound
sorry.
Of kids screaming and having fun brings you such joy because it brings you back to when I was a kid.
Okay.
And even though this was a documentary about somebody who is missing, probably passed away, probably murdered, there were still moments like, yeah, like talking on the phone, passing notes with friends. And I went back to like the innocence of being a kid.
Yeah. And it's just sad. It's tragedy. That's what this is. It's a tragedy all around. There is no redeeming moment. There is no silver lining in this. And that's what I think this documentary failed at.
Mm.
I think what could have changed everything is a final scene where Stephen brought his kids to meet mom. They'd never met her before. I think that's what they needed. And I think he needs that. And I think they need that. But
don't you think that'd be too mushy? I think it would. I think I would have objected to that.
I don't think so.
How about rolling over the credits? We have that.
That
you know what I mean?
Fine.
Like in the background, yes. like a little square.
Yes.
And the credits are rolling.
Or at least, you know, a chyron that says, you know, that they finally got together and everything was fine.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. I think it was unsatisfying because of that. I'll tell you this.
Whoa, are we going to rate this?
Many times.
Should we rate this out of like...
Maybe,
five,
but many
stars?
Times I've done a number of investigative series, and I'll tell you every single time we sold a series, it was because there is some kind of outcome.
Okay, so I get what you're saying. So you're saying we're not going to have an outcome to the crime, but we can have an emotional outcome.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
There you go.
I'll buy that.
All right.
So who did it? Come on, say who did it.
Warnie, as far as I can recall, you said you committed a crime recently.
Yeah, but my crime...
It might have been that.
Mine's a misdemeanor, and I'm taking it to the grave, even though it was...
No, you're not. You already told everybody in the world about it.
Yeah, but I didn't say what the crime was specifically, but I was caught on five neighborhood cameras.
Yeah.
Caught the crime.
Very forensically sophisticated and criminal.
So you don't want to speculate. I believe it's the boyfriend.
Okay, I believe you.
And I don't think the mom knows anything, and
I think the mom and dad are both hiding something more than just, I don't know what happened.
So what are we're just going to end this conversation the way they end the documentary?
Well, I would like to know from your listeners, our listeners, our viewers, whatever, what they think after they see it. They should watch it.
Yeah, and you can find Jim Clemente on social media, at Jim Clemente. You can find me. I'm at Ornie Adams, and you can email me if you want us to discuss further anything specific, because there's so much more. Jim has hundreds of pages of notes, okay? It's like the letter. It's written in his weak hand, okay? The weak hand wrote this. Is that what you call it, the weak hand?
Yes.
But you can contact me at whatswrong@ornieadams.com. That's my podcast email, but I'll answer any questions. And
of
I think
course
that,
he will.
I think this was good.
And he'll confess to crimes.
If we had... only the misdemeanors. If we had watched this together, would we have been pausing it the whole time?
Yeah, I have to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you watch it alone?
I did.
You did.
But I made sure I went back over things. I did try to get as much of the note down as I could, and because it's incredibly important. What I would love to do is have Jim Fitzgerald, who's a forensic linguistic profiler, actually go through that note and let him decide without knowing anything else.
Do you know him?
Yeah, he's
so
my
contact
buddy.
Well, why don't we?
Because we don't have the entire note, but I think we can probably recreate it.
Oh, let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on, Jim.
All right, it's
I
always
appreciate
great.
It. Yeah.
Always great hanging
Happy
with you.
Happy Fourth of July.
Fourth of July.
Once again, this is Ornie Adams, comedian, Jim Clemente, profiler. You know, battling it out, and we were covering today the documentary Reasonable Burden of Proof. Next week, we're covering the documentary You Have the Right to Remain Silent. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
All right, take care. That's cool.